All right, guys, welcome this is going to be episode two of the Renegade HB podcast, and we're kind of continuing on this theme of the Battletech trading card game and kind of riding this wave. We got a lot of good interest in the last one, and appreciated kind of reaching out to you guys. Peter, I know we missed you on the first episode, and good stuff getting you in for this next one is going to be awesome, and I know we have another one already lined up between you and Mark Roberts, one of the top players back in the day, to talk in the future. But for today's episode, I wanted to kind of dive into a little bit more, kind of, hear a little bit about Peter and Gustav's experience in the early game, kind of what that scene was like. And I got a lot of people just kind of asking a lot about kind of decks and deck building. And so for this episode, I really want to kind of dive in and maybe actually kind of put your three heads together and kind of go through the deck building process, maybe as an example, so people can kind of follow along and kind of see what goes in, what the considerations are as you go through. But yeah, so welcome, Michael, Gustav, Peter, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Great to be back.
So Michael, we kind of covered a little bit about your early background. Gustav, can you tell us a little about, when did you first find the trading card game and how did you kind of get involved?
I was in college, freshman in college in 96, and trading card games were just exploding, the mid-90s. And we had numerous card games that were being played in my dorm and on the halls, and Battletech was one of them. FAFSA was in the heyday of the tabletop game. There was a lot of interest in MechWarrior in general, and the books were being printed, and Michael Stackpole is an amazing writer, so we started looking at the game. And at that point in time, it was just the first two sets, the limited, unlimited, and Counter-Strike that were out. So it was all about building fast attack decks for those of us that were competitive.
Awesome. What was your favorite Stackpole book? Which one?
Blood of Kerensky.
Nice. The early round. I think I might have picked the Way of the Clans as my first one, and then found the Blood of Kerensky trilogy. But that
it's
was
so
my favorite for decades.
The Blood of Kerensky. It's the stuff.
Awesome. Peter, when did you pick it up? I think you were saying earlier that you were pretty young.
I was. I'm probably the youngest guy here. I think Battletech for me actually started with the cartoon. I was like 10 or 11, and we'd get up at 5 in the morning to watch it because every kid was playing it on the playground. MechWarrior 2 came along, and then the next thing along was a card game. So, my brothers and I had never played a card game before, and we picked it up. Awesome. And I played it, I think, until it expired. We had a few hundred cards because we were just kids, just what our allowance could afford. And I started playing it online. I think Prentice really kept me with it for a while. I taught myself really what the game was about there, and I guess I've just kind of stuck with it ever since. So
awesome. Now, what was, Gustav, as the kind of oldest in the group, what kind of was the competitive scene around your area? What was it look like? How did it evolve in those early days?
Well, I went to a pretty conservative college, so we hosted our own tournaments. We weren't part of DSI affiliated. We didn't have official tournament judges when we were playing 96, 97, 98. Once I got out of undergrad, I was able to play with some of the bigger names in person, like Peter Sundholm and those guys, because we had transitioned into another game that just came out, the Lord of the Rings game. So we would go to major events, and I would still play Battletech because I had those cards with me, and I would play with other people at major events, Origins, Gen Con, DecipherCon, those kind of places. When it was in its heyday, I was only able to play tournaments, the local scene, non-DCI sanctioned tournaments, just because of the restrictions placed on me by the school that I went to. So we had a lot of tournaments. The Mechless deck was popular. The Boom Wolf deck was popular. Before the Errata, when Arsenal came out, the Oops Bulldog Swarm, another popular deck with all vehicles. So we had the same meta, I would say, that I saw later on when I reviewed places like Command Circuit and Sarna for deck lists in the early 2000s, but it was much more isolated, which your eyes are open when you go online and like Apprentice, or I worked with Bug Laden. I scanned at high resolution all the sets in, because I had at that point in time the funds to buy all the sets, and uploaded all the scans into the CCG Workshop before that got closed down. So we were able to play online in the early 2000s, and it was pretty great.
Awesome. Definitely a benefit of being older as you get into the game is you have that income to kind of actually dive in and get a sale of the cards. You also have another distinct feature, because I think you're the only one here that's played Peter. world champion of many days, kind of what, when you, I've actually been trying to connect with him. I haven't had any, I've been searching. I've found Terry and he's down to have a conversation, but I haven't been able to find Peter yet. But what was it kind of like playing with him, when you're able to kind of connect later after the,
he's an interesting character. He's very much a persona. He's not a stoic dude. He is a very funny animated guy. He's got a mullet. He wears a bandana. He's really a fun and entertaining character to play with. And he was an associated with the people that I was associating with in those other card games as well. So I was able to hang out with him and just enjoy his presence. And he's always a class act. I brought my my free deploy Hasty Alliance Tasks Force Serpent deck, and I gave him, here is your World Championship deck. Let's play, because he didn't bring his cards with him. and he was willing to do that, which I mean, in hindsight, that's really obnoxious to demand a world champion, here, play me with your deck, my deck's going to beat it, kind of thing. But he's a very graceful guy. Oh, yeah, it crushed him. I had the turn three lock with the coordinator down. It was over.
Yeah.
So
he did the same thing to me deck. The first time we played, yeah.
Did I play you, Peter, before? Oh, yeah.
We played a couple of times.
I don't recall. I'm sorry.
We've exchanged pleasantries. I pulled out some janky deck. I was like, all right, we'll just have fun. And you're like, here's Hasty Alliance to SRMA. And just wham, it was over in four turns.
Yeah, it's I'm a pretty competitive deck builder. Silly Wiz and I go back to the early 2000s in deck building. He is much more inclined to build the idiosyncratic jank person deck around one particular thing, hoping that works one time and he's excited and happy about it. I'm much more about looking at the odds of getting, six times of each card in a deck, and how quickly can you get your combo going? How fast can you maximize and minimize the deck construction and consistency? So,
and that's the way I approach it. Looking for liability is what you're saying, where somebody always looks for flash.
Yes, I'm looking for liability. So all extraneous unessentials are culled out, and then we are looking to make the most competitive deck possible.
Definitely.
It's funny. You talking about the get the things that work and then put six of each of them in the deck. I remember distinctly a conversation that I had with Peter back when we were first getting to know each other. So a bit of history. Peter founded the Facebook group when he saw that the Yahoo group was starting to disappear. I came on board shortly thereafter, but we got to know each other, I think, in 2018. And I remember having a conversation with you about Relentless Assault Steiner deck, which is Relentless Assault is a mission for 80-ton mechs. And I said, well, Peter taught me a lot about how to build a deck, because I remember I handed this to you and I said, this seems reasonable to me. What would you do with it? And you started sort of tearing into it and changing it around. There was a lot less of the theme. So what struck me as interesting is that Gustav was saying, like, I'm looking for the thing that works, and I put six of everything that's related to that thing in the deck, and then I make it like super reliable. And I just remember, Peter, the way you took my deck that was kind of like that, but then you sort of reversed the process and threw in more esoteric elements, and it just worked better. So it's not always the right solution to just make sure you have six of everything that works the best in combination, right?
Absolutely. You want to have a sideboard for contingency plans. I agree.
Yeah, I think, some cards you just don't want to draw six of. I mean, there are things, it shouldn't always be 1/10 of your deck. Do I need six Relentless Assaults? Probably not. I might need four or five. Yeah,
but why? And this is what I hadn't picked up. Why do you not need six Relentless Assaults? And the answer is that if you don't have the element of surprise, people will already plan for your missions. It's like good shooting, right? The first good shooting you play takes your opponent by surprise and it scores a kill where they weren't expecting it. The second good shooting that you play might catch your opponent by surprise, might score a kill that they weren't expecting. By the time you play your third good shooting, your opponent is already making assumptions and half the value of the card is lost because they won't let themselves be put in a position that will allow them to be punished harshly by that card. And so for that reason, like, you take six of the same mission, it usually doesn't work.
Right. Right. Absolutely. I agree with you, Michael. But there are situations where having six of 100-ton Daiichi Primes and Widowmakers in a deck can make it happen. You can win the game on turn four with this deck. Right?
Let's stop. This is, right?
Is this the Koshi Cannon deck, or is this the Omnimech double overtime
loose,
deck?
Loose Cannon deck. Loose Cannon deck. You can win the game on turn four with six Daiichi Prime and a Widowmaker in your deck.
Since you've got it out there, do you want to take a take a little detour and explain to our listeners what this ridiculous thing does?
It wins. And it uses
yeah, how?
All right, what's happening here? What's the deck?
So it starts off with this. You have to have the Alliance. The Alliance Arc Royal Defense Cordon allows you to have both Steiner and Wolf Allegiance in your deck at the same time. This is super important because there are cards that are essential to allowing you to get the cards you need and also get the combo pieces the fastest. So the first combo piece is Trial by Bloodrite. Mm-hmm. There are six of those in there. They're a command card that lets you search your deck to get a pilot card and put it on one of your mechs as soon as possible. Then you have the Koshier. This little guy right here can get in. And even if they have a blocker, you have inside job. You have inside job to ensure that you can't be blocked. You have Melissa Steiner to pull back your combo pieces because she is a Steiner. You've got the Assassin that has jump so you can get initiative. And then the combo, of course, is to ensure that the top card of your deck is one of those Daiichis. You have seven Daiichis to choose from. And you've taken the time to use Report from the Watch so you know it's on top of your deck. That plus the loose cannon that you pulled with the combo piece, the trial, allows you to play Expert Timing, and you get plus X, plus initiative and plus attack based on the loose cannons card that you played. So you're looking at this cost of 19, and with Expert Timing, you basically milled their entire deck away with one hit off the stockpile. Have you been hit by that, Peter?
Never been hit by it. I've tried to use it. It's pretty janky. It's fun when it goes off, but it's. I think I've got it to work twice ever.
Once was against myself. It's worth mentioning, by the way, that the Travis can post-process and pull up the cards in the window, so you don't necessarily need to.
I don't have to flash the deck.
To stop, Gustav. I'm like, are you here to talk about Battletech or just show off your collection?
No. I'll take a break.
Mark Roberts did a series on Facebook. He was doing Deck of the Week, and he did 3 weeks in a row, which was things to do with your Daishi. One of them was the Koshi Cannon deck. One of them was the Omnimech Podcast deck. I don't remember what the third one was. The Omnimech Podcast deck is based on getting a third turn Widowmaker.
I don't know what the third one would be either, because those are the only two I really know of with Daishis. I've hard built a Daishi. Well, you could do double overtime.
It's a double overtime already in the Omnimech Podcast. You double overtime to get a Daishi B. And then you Omnimech Podcast it into a Widowmaker, which has the dual effect of getting a bigger one out and also getting it straight out into the patrol region.
Yeah.
Just in seeing that brings up a question that I wanted to kind of ask you guys later, but we can do it now. It's just, as I'm kind of getting in and getting and starting to play, I just wonder what could have been done to make those bigger mechs more viable and easier to play without kind of like the combinations that you're showing us there, and what you guys think, fantasy could have been, better, would have happened if, what kind of your perspective, maybe people can errata in kind of house rules or whatnot so that they can make those bigger mechs more viable. So it's not just fast mechs, medium mechs all the time.
Well, the easiest way to do that would be to double your stockpile size. If you're willing to say my stockpile pile is 120 cards instead of 60. These little decks that we're going to be talking about, the ones that can pump out two mechs per turn. And I'm looking at you, the other Swarm deck specifically, which is a high level. It's a tier, I would say tier two, tier 1.5 level tournament deck that can put two mechs out a turn and can just swarm the board and does very well in competitive play. But that will not happen, and you will lose traction if your opponent has a deck size that's, you know, 120 cards rather than 60 cards, because then the ability for your opponent to use those the logistic resources that can put two resources on a mech under construction that has at least five or can tap for three. I see those kind of resources that are not coming to mind right off the top of my head, but I have them. Improved construction facilities. There we go. That would be it. Those ones benefit from a longer game.
I disagree with you, and here's why. I think that a swarm deck, there are two kinds of ways to do a swarm deck. One way is to go for the jugular, and the other way is to use it to establish battlefield dominance. And I think that you're overestimating the former and underestimating the latter. An Ullr swarm deck can achieve battlefield dominance to the point where that improved construction facilities just won't survive, right? It doesn't matter if I've achieved battlefield dominance, it doesn't matter what size your stockpile is, I'm still going to beat you. I can offer two alternative ideas. The first thing is that, so I talked about it in the previous podcast, it's the idea of the original sin in mech pricing. So you guys are familiar with Magic. In Magic, like the default cost is a 1-1 cost 1, a 2-2 cost 2, a 3-3 cost 3, and so on, right? Now imagine for a second if you were playing Magic and a 3-3 cost 1, a 4-4 cost 2, and a 5-5 cost 3 resources or mana. All of a sudden, you'd see a skew downwards, right? Because why pay 3 for a 5-5 when you could pay 1 for a 3-3? And that is what has happened with Battletech. I spent a lot of time working on mech pricing, and every card gets 5 free points to spend on armor, structure, attack, and speed. So where I would go is I would reprice cards. I would do it something like this. First of all, no free points. So every point of attack costs 1 resource. Every point of armor costs 2/3 of resource. Every point of structure costs 1/2 a resource. And then speed is a multiplier. A slow mech costs par, a moderate mech costs 25% more, a fast mech costs 50% more, and an extra fast mech maybe 75% more. But the point being that now, if you do the math, you end up with a Basakari A that costs 15 resources and a Fenris Prime that would cost something like 9 or 10. The idea being that you're bringing the percentages, that may not be the exact right math to use, but the idea that you pay for what's on the table and you try to bring the percentages of the cost more into line. Maybe a Fenris Prime should cost 1/2 of a Masakari A, not 1/3. Less than 1/3, that sort of thing.
Yeah. What do you guys think about that?
I agree. The costing is ridiculous in BattleTech.
Yeah.
The entire card game, the costing. The people who did the costing did not know the value of those low cost, under costed mechs, which is why Night Sky is so dominant. In the when Mercenary came out, everybody wanted to play 6 Night Sky Inner Sphere because the costing of the Night Sky, the original Night Sky, is so amazing. And why people who are playing Clan like Peter would put the Inferno Missile retrofits to slap and cripple Night Skies with their terrible overheats in their sideboard, just so that you could have a chance against the Inner Sphere Swarm decks.
And looking even for me, you know, the cards that we're playing with, my girlfriend and I are kind of focused more on that kind of limited Counter-Strike at this point. And just, you know, is my inexperience with the game, or is there a tendency where the clan decks just tend to kind of overpower a lot of the Inner Sphere decks? Is that the case early on, or are we just not kind of getting the advanced tactics at this point, or deck building? Or maybe it takes more rare cards to kind of balance it out?
No. I think you have to play with the factions as they were at the time of Limited and Unlimited. So the Mongoose is the number one clan killing mech. The fact that it can survive a Dasher Prime right out of the gate and stay alive is huge. And you have to be able to play Mongooses. You have to be able to play the Centurions, the Wolfhounds, and then be ready for the clan and have those lured into the bog or whatever you need to be able to handle the clan's speed advantage. And hopefully you can catch them with your Zeus and do what you need to do.
Well, it makes me feel good because we drifted to the, when I was building, my girlfriend wasn't building decks, but I drifted to the Mongoose and Wolfhound. And I actually didn't pull any Centurions, oddly. But we were using Perimeter Alarm to kind of help slow that down a little bit. We didn't have, but yeah.
Perimeter Alarm works, yeah. Lured into the Bog is a surprise, though. Everybody can see a Perimeter Alarm when it's in play, but not everybody knows Lured into the Bog, boom. Now it's time to go down.
Well, and again, the surprise factor of missions is such a huge part of how you play missions. Mm-hmm.
And that kind of leads me, and you had a comment there, Gustav, that about a topic I want to dive into, of just having been there at the beginning and kind of watching the game evolve and kind of, well, all of you guys can kind of, you know, speak to this and how, you know, kind of the meta evolved with each set. You know, you guys had that knowledge of kind of like competitive play when nobody had seen a Mercenaries card, nobody had seen a Mech Warrior. Kind of what were kind of like the turning points in the game that happened as each of those were released and kind of what evolved in terms of the meta and how people approached the game as it evolved through those 3 years?
Michael, I think you talked about, were you there at the beginning when it was just Limited and Unlimited?
Oh, yeah. Again, I mean, I was a kid. We had tournaments, but when I got exposed to different metas initially by talking to Peter, because Peter was the only other super experienced player that I had met, you know, in the last 5 years until you and Mark showed up in the Facebook group. But it's clear to me that the meta that we had back in New Zealand when I was playing competitively was comparatively poor. Even so, it was pretty clear, for example, that Counter-Strike was a massive disappointment. I remember people being seriously upset that the cards in Counter-Strike in general were so poor. There were a few highlights, and of course those highlights are very high, right? Black Market Connections, Overrun, Risky Combat Jump, Superior Navigation. Like, you've got some incredibly good cards, but apart from that, it was very, like, the average was low. The best cards were truly amazing, but the averages were really low, and people were upset.
I agree. I remember in class opening packs of Counter-Strike because I bought a box and opening them in class, and I was like, there's got to be more than one Superior Navigations in here. This is ridiculous. It's just trash. It's all binder folder that is worthless. Nobody was ever going to be able to get out Ulrich Kerensky, 10 plus massive politics buyouts. Just, that's my rare. And those kind of things really were disappointing in Counter-Strike. Yeah. The ability, though, of the dead pile recursion with Black Market Connections, though, I mean, that's a must-have. One, maybe two in every single deck. That's a must-have.
Yeah.
I had actually just asked Michael this week about Ulrich Kerensky because I was trying to make up. I was going to get some little fan-made cards, worked up for the game, and Ulrich was a favorite character, you know, also as a Stackpole Blood of Kerensky fan, and I had asked Michael. He wasn't sure of the answer. Maybe you guys can, but I was like, if to make Ulrich Kerensky a viable card, how would he cost?
I would hypothesize 6+4T.
Okay.
Or 6+5L or something like that, maybe.
Any of you guys got thoughts?
I think you give him multiple buyouts, but you bring his cost down by half. If you make him a 5-drop, but give him buyouts for logistics and politics, I think that's there's a way to make that happen. But
how do you play politics in a competitive deck, really?
Think tank.
Yeah.
First set. Think tank. I suppose. Absolutely.
But still, I guess if you have them in your hand, you burn the think tank. If you don't, you still got a resource. The thing that bugs me about cards like Ulrich is that a competitive game is built on tempo so heavily because the CCG biases swarm, you know, mech sizes. Tempo is a huge component, and the amount of tempo that you lose by playing Ulrich. Ulrich is going to take two turns to pay himself back, and he could have been a mech, but he wasn't. And I imagine that those two turns could make the difference between life and death. If you look at improved construction facilities, if you look at top tournament decks that play improved construction facilities, they almost never pay its cost. They're almost always doing it via merchant cast because the tempo loss of paying its cost is so high.
Absolutely.
Gotcha. What are some favorite cards that you guys have of, or maybe just mechs or names that weren't viable in the game that you've kind of fantasized about kind of remodeling to make them viable? You guys kind of live in that world.
Martha's Pride.
Okay.
Martha's Pride. Yeah. The Pride's Pride.
Yeah.
Mech. It's insane. It's insane. Those mechs that are, you're looking at, you know, the 15, you like the Loki A, those ridiculously overcosted clan mechs that have almost no structure and barely any armor, and their overheat kills them before they even see an opponent.
Right.
Now, to be fair, that happens in the board game too.
The Lokis.
The Black Hawk Prime is dumb in the board game as well as in the card game.
Yeah, I understand, but I would like to see those be more viable mechs.
Yeah.
They did, by the way, they're, since I've spent a lot of time on the costing formulas, I'll say that they did. There's three things that I think are worth bringing up for the mechs. Right? One is that they did not understand how to cost Alpha Strike correctly. They costed it way too high, which is why mechs like the Hunchback 2C are overpriced. They costed Alpha Strike. They costed.
Big overheats
overheats where the overheat is a large fraction of your armor are a huge problem. And the other one is
you mean structure?
No, of your armor, because if I'm in a battle and nobody shoots at me and I use my overheat, how affected will I be? Like after armor, overheat pain minus armor, if that is large, then it's a huge problem. Okay. And the third thing is that in the Battletech board game, mechs that have missiles and direct energy weapons work extremely well and are beloved, right? Mm-hmm. The Mad Cat is a prime example. Bunch of lasers or PPCs, bunch of LRMs. Everybody loves the Mad Cat. But in the CCG, because of the way missiles were designed, it just doesn't work, right? Having a combination of direct energy and missile loadouts results in an inefficient mech in the CCG, and so you don't end up playing very beloved mechs because they don't work well in the CCG. So if there had been a better way to do missiles, that would have, I think, made a lot of people very happy.
I think that's more about missiles than it is about just a mixing of them, because, you know, the biggest death sentence in the CCG for a mech is probably missile one. Because it doesn't do anything well. I think the way the missiles were designed, the only way you can make them work is to boat them and then make them highly consistent with modifiers like NARC and targeting ace. And if you don't have that, it's more or less just a random set of damage you can throw at the stockpile, because you don't even roll for it before you determine damage.
Right.
So yeah, you can't rely on it to do damage to units, and it just hurts the unit altogether.
Would it be a practical house rule if, you know, since it's been 20 years since there's been any official word, and the game can be whatever we want it to be, really, what would be the effects of a house rule that simply said, roll your dice first, then apply them? How would that change matters?
I would still be wary about using them. Just because, like I said, when you plan out your blockers or your attackers for a mission, I look at it and say, okay, this is what he's going to attack or block with, so I need to make sure I have enough damage to get a kill. Because a damage mech doesn't help you at all. It retains all of its damage and all of its field presence. It can still block another mech. It can still initiate an attack. It can still, I mean, it's still an effective combat unit. So damage is not useful. Kills are. And if I can't rely on how much damage I'm going to do to get that kill, or if I'm going to have to worry I waste damage and dramatically overkill it, it's still not a useful effect. So I end up doing the same thing and just throw it at the stockpile and hope for the best. And if I use it defensively, if it happens, great, but I can't rely on it either way. So, you know, missiles, they need the modifiers to be useful.
Peter, it comes down to consistency.
Yeah,
it all missiles comes down are to not consistent.
Everything comes down to consistency.
Exactly. And when you min-max a deck, this is why missile decks never, ever make top tier, ever, because you cannot have missile decks that are consistent. You just can't. You cannot put together your missile boats fast enough that don't get hunted down, that don't get tapped down. It's not consistent enough, which is why missiles, the entire costing scheme for missiles and the rolling of a dice, making it random, was the death knell for so many mechs.
So I was going to actually talk to you about this, because dice rolling at a competitive level always bothers me. You know, if you're a competitive player, you trust enough in your skill that you don't want to have to flip a coin to decide who's going to win the game.
Tell that to Risky Combat Jump and tell that to Superior Navigation.
That's what I'm segueing to. That is exactly what I'm segueing to. But then we look at it, and some of the best missions in the game are dice rolls. You know, Risky Combat Jump, Superior Navigation, more limited extent, Steel Talons. These missions are in just about every competitive deck, or at least a top eight of every, you know, some of the decks will have them. Because at the end of the day, there is no other card that provides similar benefits. Nothing provides a large amount of damage prevention and damage the way that Risky does. Nothing enables a single mech to hunt down, or a single small mech to hunt down resources the way Superior Navigation does. And there's no mission that's even close to Steel Talons. So, you know, it's sort of interesting how much, even if we don't want it, there is a ton of RNG at the competitive level. Even vehicles. I mean, you know, vehicles come and go based on a die roll, and that can have major implications. I've won or lost games, whether a Risky worked or a vehicle died. So yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, my main competitive background in gaming has been with Star Wars X-Wing miniatures, which is definitely, mm-hmm. I mean, that's all dice. And there was, like, my early stint in there, you know, I was, you know, what was the second Magic the Gathering player, the one that kind of, you know, gets really mad if they lose one thing and it wasn't their fault? I forgot what that archetype. You guys know what I'm talking
about? Spike. Oh, that's the Spike. Spike okay, plays 10 games and he wins 9, but he lost 1 and he thought he should have won it, so he walks away unhappy.
Yeah, and that was me. I was the Spike, you know, but then, and when I embraced the fact that, you know, you had to play to, well, one, if you're playing with dice, everybody was playing with dice in that game, whereas in Battletech, some people could be playing with missiles and some people not. But once I kind of got comfortable with the fact that luck was a part of it, man, my experience elevated and on my gameplay elevated, because I was just more focused and there. But right. I can see, like, with Battletech, it's not even playing field. If someone's coming in and they're, you know, building something like what Gustav is saying, and then someone else is like, oh, these cards are fun, let me roll some dice and see what happens.
So I think that if we think about this as our game, in the sense that there hasn't been an official word for 20 years and it can be whatever we want it to be, I think the mental trap that we have to avoid is we have to avoid, like, the tier one tournament level mental trap. We know, like, the Battletech CCG meta has been solved. We know what works at the tier one level. We know what doesn't. And the tier one level is fundamentally not very interesting, right? Because, yes, you can show up with your Task Force SERP and Hasty Alliance deck, and that's great. Or you can show up with your SRMA deck with your Galleons and your Bulldogs, and that's great. But it's not fundamentally interesting. I think that what we should be targeting as a community is a rich range of options at tier two, right? Because at tier two, things broaden out. A lot more of the things that exist in the game can be practically used, and you cover a lot more turf while still essentially asking players to get good, right? You any player should be able to reach like a level of skill and understanding with effort that puts them in like a low tier two for competitive play, especially if they have access to all the cards because they're online. But I think we just need to forget about tier one, or if not forget about it, as I've advocated before, like squash it down by errata-ing the meta spikes that leads to its existence. Like Task Force Serpent, it's trivial to change it. It was talked about 15 years ago already. Just make it removed from the game. Like end of story. But if we focus on that really broader and more interesting tier two level, people can do a lot more. A lot more different factions become competitive. Someone can say, well, I really like Ghost Bear. And, you know, instead of saying, well, there aren't any Ghost Bear tier one decks.
There are. I disagree.
There's two of them.
I disagree. I played against the world champion in 2002 that won with a Ghost Bear deck.
All right. Well, so insert.
Jason and I played games.
Insert faction here.
Okay.
Right. A rich life of in tier two, I think, should be our target as a community. I'm interested in whether you guys agree with that.
Well, we had touched on that first episode about drafting at the end, and I know in talking with Gustav, before the podcast, he had mentioned like a good experience of setting up drafts. So maybe we dive in. Do you guys think that that's kind of a way to set up and ensure more fun and more balance?
I agree. Open draft. We had an open draft. I did it in 2002, I believe, or summer of 2001. And we had players from around the world, Germany, England, the United States, all playing. It was like a 1 month draft league. I'm pretty sure that SillyWiz, Mark Roberts, still has those, the deck lists and the draft pods results. And that's an article, the choices of draft when we were drafting those cards and how the decks that came together. Because I think some people were able actually to put together the pieces for Evil Dasher deck with the Fire Moth D and the Feral Fibrous Armor and the Elite Mech Warrior. I think at least one person was able to pull that off out of a draft. So that's pretty fun. If you get that, that's the holy triumvirate of Battletech, to put those three together. I mean, and heaven forbid that you actually got an effective groundwork as well, because whoa, that's like the coup de grace.
Drafting with banned cards.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because when it comes down to it, Michael, when you're drafting, you cannot have that negative play of experience for every single turn four having that combo on the board, because you get one of those in your entire draft deck. But if you can put it all together, the high that you feel, I mean, that's the Johnny high when we're talking the different types of players, and that is the Johnny high that people like SillyWiz go nuts over.
I'll buy it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you could definitely do it drafted, and I mean, you can probably even get away with the banned cards, because the chances of even drafting all three of Elite Mech Warrior, Dasher D, and Pharaoh is very low. And yeah, assembling it's great. Playing against it, not so much, but you could definitely look into doing a draft league. I think you get some interest with that, because I do kind of agree, going back to what you were saying. For the most part, the tournament scene, there's not going to be a lot of motion in it. I mean, we know what works, what doesn't work. And I do like, I personally enjoy playing a step below that, because it is a lot more open. The problem you run into that with is it's subjective. What is and what is not tier two? But it is a lot of fun.
I mean, my approach was I look at what shows up in at the top of the game, and I just took a few cards and I squashed them down. It was interesting to see what would survive that, right? Because when you throw out the cheese potential of Sandra's Royal Military Academy, Task Force Serpent, and Solaris Contacts and Urchin Cast, what truly survives that? Like, if you look at the 2001, which was the last, 2000, like the Tony Miracle's Strategic Bombardment deck survives it perfectly well, right?
There's so does nothing. Elementals.
Yes.
Boom Wolf is still around, although I don't know if that goes back up to it. Mechless might still be good.
Mechless doesn't work without disguise coordinates anyway.
Yeah, the disguise Steiner coordinates errata was terrible. Give me my disguise coordinates back. Make Mechless decks great again.
all right. Point is, Steiner, I think that constructed tournaments don't feel like they don't feel like they would give anything particularly interesting unless you were fairly heavy-handed about what couldn't be played. Like, you forced the tournament down by essentially, by functionally banning certain decks. But then someone's still going to pull out Boomwolf because they know what it is, because they have the internet, right?
I think, Michael, in another competitive game that I also played with Peter Sundholm, the Lord of the Rings game, they did just that. They issued an X list and a restricted list. So an X list were the banned cards, and there was like 13 banned cards that were overpowered in Standard. And then they issued a restricted list, which is, these are, you normally can play, in this particular game, you could have four of a copy. In Battletech, we get to have six, but you can play one of a copy of a card in a deck. On a restricted list. So if the players committee, if we had a players committee for Battletech that could agree to those, an X list and a restricted list, I think you would open the that tier two wide open. Because if there's only one Sandhurst Royal Military Academy in a deck, I tell you what, that weenie deck is a lot weaker if there's only one.
I mean, I have, in a sense, tried to recruit, you know, you dudes to be that group. I put together that errata set. Like, my fix for SRMA isn't the same. I actually ended up working with Mark Roberts on that for a while. He was interested for a while in giving me some thoughts about what would work. The solution that we had for Sandhurst was different. It was that because it relies on unpiloted mechs, using Sandhurst on a unit, would render that unit piloted. And so I thought the real problem with Sandhurst deck was not the fact that you had six of them, but the fact that you could use multiple Sandhursts on an individual unit and then untap all of them. So that was the fix that we had there. But if you look at what was in 2000, right? If you do something with war funds, with merchant cast, with Sandhurst, and with Solaris contacts, and a couple of other tinkerings on the side, you resolve most of the problem. And I stand by that solution. I would say that we do know how to do this. It's just,
well, I agree. I agree. I don't even think an errata is necessary. I just think a restricted list where if you can play your card as listed, but there's only one of them in the deck. Goes back to my deck construction, where I like to have six of every card that makes the deck tick, and then the sideboard for contingencies. And your deck is not nearly as consistent as an SRMA free deploy deck when there's only one.
I was thinking that was funny from you coming from Mr. Consistency, and then it reply the one of. And I almost question it because, you know, I go back to the thing I said about consistency as well. Now we're down to, do they draw it or do they not draw it? And if they do draw it, the power level of the deck skyrockets. If they don't, well, they're underpowered. So are we going back to the same problem we had of, you know, missiles, where it's just almost random chance whether you get it or not?
Yeah, I agree with Peter. I think an SRMA deck is perfectly reasonable that such a thing should exist, right? With six SRMAs, because it's an interesting space in the meta to explore. I just don't want it to be crazy good. I just want it to be good, right? And so that's why I wouldn't choose a restricted list as the solution.
Yeah, I just know, coming from the older Magic formats where they have the one-ofs, you know, they still see play, but it's almost random chance whether you get them or not.
And which is why those decks don't show up as much.
Well, they, right? Do. If you go back, like, you know, the very old Magic formats, like Vintage and stuff, they do still play the one-of stuff. And it's very, very good when you get it. But, you know, it's random whether you do. So they're good enough on their own. They're just slightly better with the one-ofs. So they don't build the deck around it. So the SRMA as a concept would probably die. You'd just be playing free deploy, and hey, if I get this massive damage modifier, cool.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I would still play six of the arms reductions, and I probably would still play politics or hasty alliance to get out some contracts to give me my buffs for my free deploy mechs. But I won't have six SRMAs in there.
Right. But again, I think you have to ask the question, to resolve the tier one problem, do you want to delete the concept or weaken the concept? And I don't mean delete the card or weaken the card. I mean, like, the concept. We know how an SRMA deck plays. the question is, do we want to send it behind the woodshed, or do we just want to put it in a straitjacket? And I would be for putting it in a straitjacket, because it sort of reduces diversity when you send the best things around behind the woodshed and kill them off. I like the idea of the diversity of options. I just don't want them to be so spiky.
I think both of these choices would, effectively neuter the deck down to where it needs to be. The question is, like I said, it's a question of how you want to neuter this deck. The one-off solution, like, you're really making a new deck that just happens to have, you know, almost like Takashi Kurita's legacy is basically what you put in the deck now. Right. It's a one-off, and great, you get it. Because, you're effectively making them unique is what you're really doing.
Exactly.
I don't like the uniques as they were designed in Battletech. I find it, even when Hasty Alliance and Task Force were added, I thought it was way too inconsistent whether you got it or not. And as a result, power level of these cards fluctuated wildly. You know, some were worth it, but 90% of them were just junk. You couldn't ever build a deck around them. So it was just a nice thing to run into. And, I mean, there's different opinions on that. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm a huge fan of Takashi Kurita in a hidden location. I have built that deck. It sends your opponents into fits of rage. It's not competitive, but it sends your opponents into fits of rage.
Yeah.
But yeah,
this guy's coordinates needs to come back.
I gave it an errata that did bring it back. It just said it only works for one attack.
Nope. You need to be able to put the stall button on. If you can put the stall button on, you can cycle those back with black market connections. You have to send it to a legal. I recognize people were sending it to the scrap heap as the attack, and they errated that. You have to send it against a legal target. So you put like an assembly underneath it and put a bunch of constructions on an assembly. Okay.
Yeah, I think we'll disagree on that one. I think mechless decks. I mean, the great strength of Battletech is its tactical play. It's not its card play, right? When I've got four or five mechs down on the table, and you've got four or five mechs down on the table, and I'm starting to think about, well, if I attack this with those, then you're going to do that, which allows me to do this, which will hopefully, you know, result in you doing that, right? And that sort of driving your opponent into decision making with what you have down on the table, I think that's what separates a game of Battletech from a game of Magic. Whereas with Magic, it's much more about, this is the card I have in my hand, and this is the effect it's going to have on the table. And when I attack with these dudes all at once, all at the same target. It's not where the interesting stuff happens, right? But with Battletech, it's the missions phase is so interesting that I think if you make mechless decks more powerful, you lose the opportunity to play a game of Battletech instead of a game of Magic.
I agree. The Magic deck is the mechless deck. It, right. 100% is. 100%. But if you're a control player, which I like to play control, then you're going to like that type of style. And those, all those bombardments, the artilleries, the long toms, all of those cards don't see any play outside of Arrow 4, any play, until we had the mechless deck possibility. So it did open up an entire new archetype, but it's a control archetype.
The reason they didn't see play was they were too expensive, right? One of the other original sins of Battletech card design from Wizards was that they did not understand the relative value of a mech versus a command card. It's almost always true that if you could pay four resources to put down a mech, or you could pay four resources to put down a command card that will do stuff like an artillery piece, the mech will be the right choice. And they didn't price command cards accordingly, not in terms of resource cost and not in terms of deployment, right? You could argue that the long-term artillery would see a lot more play if it cost two, maybe. Or if it cost three or four and was a free deployment.
There you go. Now you're talking my language.
It's the deployment cost of the command cards is a huge factor.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was going to say too. I mean, it's not that they didn't understand the value of the cost. I think Long Tom has costed correctly. I think they didn't understand the value of a deployment.
That's the issue. 100%, yes. Peter. It's the issue that I only have two of those per turn, and I am so – it's tempo. You lose huge amounts of tempo if I'm losing my – using my deployments on a command card. This is only going to do 3 damage.
Yeah, so –
because you can't block.
When I'm showing people the game, and this is basically what I tell them, you know, Battletech is a fight for control of the board. If I have 4 units on the board and you have none, the game is over. So if you fall too far behind and anything you do on the board, you just lose. And that's part of the reason why, you know, playing low is better, low-cost units is better. That's part of the reason why you see so few commands, because anything you're playing that isn't a unit or a resource is putting you behind on the board.
Or a free deployment.
Right. And you fall too far behind on the board, the game is over. So, you know, if you look at that, commands, if you fall behind on the board, the only way you come back is bleeding off a couple of cards off your stockpile. You know, you let a couple of attacks through and hope you catch up, you draw more units than they do and catch back up on the board. If you have commands on the table, that option is suddenly gone because they start attacking the commands. And so if I say, okay, if I spent resources in a deployment on this command, if I don't defend it, I just wasted those resources in a deployment. If I do defend it, my board position probably gets even worse. So you end up with this situation where, okay, play resources, play commands. Anything else is a luxury, needs to pay for itself immediately, which means scrap when revealed, or do something like Steel Viper R&D team, which immediately replaces itself as a deployment, or else just don't play it. You know, stick with combat tricks like missions.
Yeah. Or refill your hand like Hidden Reserve.
Yeah, reserves, yeah.
Right.
There you
and
go.
Even Steel Viper R&D team, it's a lot of people fall in love with it because they don't understand tempo. The cost of Steel Viper R&D team, the tempo cost is still significant. And which is why you tend not to see it that much.
It's a play ahead, stay ahead card. I agree, Michael.
Yeah.
R&D is this play ahead, stay ahead. You play it when you're ahead and you stay ahead because you played it. You do not play it when you're behind.
Or even when you're even.
Nope.
So is that I'm hearing right that that's kind of a blanket kind of errata that you guys are comfortable saying that, you know, you know, just for playing at home, any command card that you put down comes with free deploy? Or are there parts where that breaks down?
I think that
no,
or there that, maybe
no.
just
that
like
down. No. I wouldn't say that. I would say that would break down. But you could theorize, if you want to play around with this house rule, I do not guarantee that it is balanced. I have no idea, but I could theorize that you could make a house rule that says any command card that you play that is not a resource, you may choose to pay one more for it and gain a free deployment. Maybe. Sorry, that is not a resource and that has a structure, no, that is a permanent, not a scrap when revealed card.
Yeah.
I agree.
I'll restate that for clarity. You could try playing any command card that you play that is not a resource and that does not say scrap when revealed, you may choose to pay one more resource for it and gain a free deployment. That would be interesting. I guarantee you, anyone who tries that and has a serious competitive mind will find a way to make it a real problem.
Well, is it
somehow,
for a house rule, it would be fun. For a house rule, it would be fun.
Yeah.
It really depends on the card. And I was actually smiling while you were saying that because I've actually designed a couple of custom cards that use that exact rule where you can pay extra to make it a free deployment. But I think it is good for fun. It'd be a good starting place. Yeah, someone will break that. It might be one of us, but
I'm with you, Peter. I like that concept, Michael. There is another card game that I played competitively, the Upper Deck Entertainment Verse, that did just that with boost cards, where the cost is printed on the card as this, but later on in the game, you have more resources down because in that particular game, everything is a resource if you choose it to be. You can play any card face down. And if you pay more for this card, it comes in with a boost, and that's a special ability on the card, which is super good. And I wish that the designers at DCI would have thought about that later on, because I really don't care to have a Saladin coming into my hand as a draw necessarily on turn 7 and 8. I would like to have that Saladin turn into an SRM carrier or something to the equivalent.
I just want a sidebar on how much I hate that 10 vehicle limit. It's the ugliest solution.
It's horrible. It's horrible.
It's horrible.
But, it's horrible. Did Arsenal come out in 97? Was it 97 that Arsenal was released?
I was going to say later than that, yeah.
Okay, because when Arsenal came out, that the fact that I could put 40 units in a in 40 units in like 15 resources than five other, because generally everybody that's played, and I'm sure you've covered this before, Travis, when you're looking at deck construction, the general rule is you want 24 units, 24 resources, and 12 other cards that make you win. That's the general basic cooking ingredients when we're making a deck. But when vehicles came out and we had the ability to have all these cards that cost nothing and had great effects, I could put in six hidden reserves for refilling my hand. The cards played themselves and were free to play, so I could empty my hand, and I could play a whole ton of cards and go through my deck at a cost to myself for my life, but I had board presence. The tempo was so huge to be able to do that, and I crushed Boom Wolf. As soon as Arsenal came out, I started cracking boxes. I crushed Boom Wolf. I would argue
that the greatest mech in the game, if you could play 40 of them, you should, is the Hollander, right? 042 moderate free deploy, right?
I think it's the best free deploy unit.
And one long range.
Sure. If you think about, it comes back to two core principles, and we've already talked about them, but it's worth tying them back. It's the five free points, right? Hollander, moderate speed, one. Four structure, two more. Two attack, two more. Free deploy, one. Five free points, cost one. Right? It's the
five long range. Doesn't it have long range, well, though, too?
I charge long range as something like 1/6 of a resource, but it's not significant.
That brings up something with the long range. You know, can you guys kind of walk through, you know, even for me, I haven't even got into the later rule sets. What are these kind of the key new rules that popped up later? Because most people like myself that are kind of popping into this game, they're going to find a starter. They might find some cheap Counter-Strike. They're not going to drop hundreds of dollars on, you know, Arsenal, Crusade, Commander's Edition. Like what are those rules that kind of popped up later, like long range?
Long range was in it from the very beginning. It's just that it didn't have a name in it.
Right. Okay. So that was just it. So whenever people are talking about long range, they're just talking about the damage that gets through to the target.
Yeah. So if you want to think about the later things, vehicles, battle armor, C3, even hand to hand was unlimited, not keyworded, but it was there.
VTOLs.
What else? VTOLs. Yeah. Vehicles and VTOLs. Terrain.
Yeah, Terrain was Mech Warrior.
Yeah, it was proto. It was difficult terrain. Was the proto terrain card in? I want to say Mercenaries, but it could be Mech Warrior.
It was early. Yeah.
Yeah, Mercenaries had the difficult terrain. So when you were talking about picking up a starter deck, Travis, I happen to have two starter decks in front of me. One of them is the original starter deck, and if you look at the thickness of the original starter deck, then you compare the thickness of the limited starter deck, and you're like, what is up with this?
Wait, what's the difference between original and limited? Hold on. What are you referring to?
Do you see that?
Yes, no. I see the size. I'm asking you, what is an original starter deck?
Isn't it just the rulebook?
Well, what are we looking at, Gustav? What's the difference?
One had a thicker rulebook in it.
I was going to say it had a rulebook, yeah.
Ah. Yeah. Yeah. I was like, so you can tell the difference if you're looking around, hey, you know, what am I going to get? Can Black you show Order the front page?
Well, they the front same. Of those things?
They look the same.
Well, they just have the serial number in the top left as the same as different.
Is one of those a limited and one of those an unlimited?
Correct.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay, got it.
Yeah. Yep.
I didn't realize that the unlimiteds didn't come with the same thickness of them.
I am so glad you brought visual aids, Gustav, because it's really been the highlight so far in this show.
All right, guys, so I'm going to cut it there for this video because the next part is a ton of fun, but it's definitely kind of its own distinct topic. We are going to be going deep dive into deck building. I kind of threw out a theme to the guys of building a deck to simulate kind of the Battle of Luthien. So a kind of a Smoke Jaguar base clan deck, and then an Inner Sphere Kurita kind of mercenary deck, and then we just went off on that and had a ton of fun. And you guys can kind of follow along and listen to the thought process of these guys starting from scratch. They gave them no primers before this, so you get from the idea to from the concept to execution there in kind of that deck building. It really is a great bit of content that I look forward to sharing you guys as soon as it's done edited. So make sure that you're staying tuned, make sure you're subscribed and you're hitting that bell notification so that you get pinged when that content gets uploaded. But in the meantime, I hope you guys really appreciated this video. I really appreciate the support that you guys have given this channel so far. We've gotten a lot of great comments and interaction with the channel. I really appreciate it. I really encourage you guys to keep kind of throwing down questions and feedback in those comments. It really kind of helps stimulate the conversation, even give me ideas for future videos, which are going to include suggestions from you guys, including tutorials for how to set this up on Lackey and Tabletop Simulator so you can play online. We're going to get some games recorded with some of the guys with some voiceover and share that with you guys. And I've also got some amazing kind of podcasts with kind of top players in the day talking about their experience in the game. We're going to do an overview of every individual card set and card to look at and think about. There's a lot of stuff that we're going to be covering, but that's not even it for the channel. It's not just a trading card game channel. That's going to be definitely a big theme early on, but you can check out that kind of podcast with Blaine Lee Pardoe, where we're talking about kind of his experience kind of contributing to the BattleTech universe. I'm going to be doing a lot more along those lines as well. So definitely kind of connect with the channel, subscribe, and keep liking these videos. It really does help. And that is it for this episode of Renegade HBG. I will catch you on the next one. Bye.